Strange things happened in Cologne in 1212. Let's go into the shadow of the old Cologne Cathedral. A young preacher named Nicholas gathered hundreds, even thousands of children and young people around him. Wearing a simple robe and a rope cross around his neck, he preached loudly that Jesus Christ had appeared to him. He was to lead a band to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims. But no warriors or knights were to join him. A procession of children was to set out and recapture Jerusalem without a fight. A plan that lacked any common sense and which was to fail miserably. This is the beginning of the story of the Children's Crusade, which is said to have taken place in Cologne in 1212. What is it all about? Let's find out straight away after the intro. I had been looking forward to dealing with this topic since the start of this podcast. In the year 1212, children really are said to have set out to go to Jerusalem. Just like that. Without much planning, apparently, completely naive about the dangers and challenges that such an undertaking entailed. Young historians are taught at university to do what is expected of the profession. Exuberant emotions are out of place. At least, that was the case during my studies. It was more a matter-of-fact scientific evaluation of historical sources such as documents, pictures, or objects. But even though it was more than 800 years ago, the idea that hundreds or perhaps thousands of children were led to their doom here still evokes horror. All of us know children, whether they are our own, those of our family, or those of friends and acquaintances. It is in our nature to want to protect children. Therefore, the events of the Children's Crusade of 1212 strike at the very core of our humanity. But is the Children's Crusade even true? And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a kind of European microcosm. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Were the events of 1212 in Cologne real? Or do they come from the realm of legends? Let's take a look at the sources, the historical sources. At least 50 different written sources were produced at the time that dealt with the subject of the Children's Crusade from Cologne. These include the Cologne Royal Chronicle, which has already been mentioned here several times, or the Marbach Annals. If you consider how poor the findings for historical sources for this period often is, the number of 50 documents sounds at least like a jackpot. But the analysis of these can still be disappointing. The reports largely contain the reproduction of rumors or hearsay. And the reports are not comprehensive either, especially when it comes to the end of the Children's Crusade. But even if all this ends up being a legend, the events of the Children's Crusade clearly show the upheavals and challenges that were taking place throughout Christian Europe at that time. But let's start with the story itself. It is the year 1212, early summer in Cologne. Nicholas, a boy perhaps around 10 or 14 years old, has a vision. Jesus Christ appears to him in a dream. He commands him to recapture Jerusalem for Christianity, and in a very special way. We'll come to that in a moment. Inspired by this inspiration, Nicholas, about whom we still don't really know anything, such as where he comes from or his social status, appears in penitential garb from now on. He's wearing a rope cross, a cross that looks like the capital letter T. Nicholas now always proclaims the same message on the streets and squares of Cologne. What crusaders, with their war horses, armor, and swords have failed to achieve in recent times, children should now do. Didn't Jesus once say, "Let the children come to me, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to people like you"? And the big attraction? Not with swords, spears, or bows and arrows, no, Nicholas wants to achieve this by singing, praying, and above all, peacefully means. And how is that supposed to work if you have to travel far, it's still a long way from Cologne to Jerusalem nowadays, even with an airplane. For Nicholas and his followers, the Mediterranean Sea is on the way if they don't want to take the long, arduous road via the Balkans and what is now Turkey. No problem either, says Nicholas. In his vision, he was assured that God would part the sea so that they could walk to Jerusalem on dry land, just as Moses and the Israelites were once able to flee Egypt through the Red Sea. Nicholas definitely saw himself in this tradition of being part of a group favored by God. Nicholas' words must have caught on with the young people. Parents desperately tried to protect their children from the attraction of Nicholas. Sometimes they beat their own children, locked them up, or begged them not to trust this boy preaching around all the time, but it often didn't help. The children escaped and ran away with Nicholas. In July 1212, Nicholas marched out of Cologne at the head of hundreds, if not thousands, of people, singing, dancing, with drums and trumpets. He was heading south, to Italy. From there, the sea would part and the dry crossing to Jerusalem would take place. At least that's what they believed. The group continues to grow as it follows the Rhine southwards. Some of the common people are even enthusiastic about the procession and give the pilgrims food for their journey. However, the local nobility, and especially the official church, they are not at all impressed by the project. Here, someone has set himself up as divinely commissioned, namely Nicholas from Cologne. This was deeply repugnant to the church. And wasn't Nicholas' criticism of the failed crusade also a criticism of the official church itself? For some high-ranking clerics, Nicholas will have been just as much a heretic as the Waldensians and the Cathars in France and Italy at the same time. After a few weeks, the Cologne Children's Crusade finally reaches the first stage. They reach the Italian city of Genoa, a large and powerful port city with bases in the then-known world. But when Nicholas and his band of several hundreds or thousand followers arrive here, disappointment sets in. Because, you might have guessed it, the sea does not part, as Nicholas had promised. So the Children's Crusade from Cologne is stranded, literally, in Genoa. North of the Alps, the sympathy of the rural population could still be relied on. Here in the cramped Italian city, the extra mouths to feed are thorn in the eyes of the Genoese. Of course, the children here, or the members of the Children's Crusade, they don't speak Italian either, so it's hard to communicate with them. Disappointed, the Children's Crusade disperses. Only a few set off for their homeland. Most are driven to completely different places. Those who return home are the victims of mockery from their contemporaries. However, historical sources are also speaking of very unpleasant circumstances. Smaller groups that wandered around after the failure in Genoa were picked up, mistreated, or even murdered. There are also reports of, albeit not fully documented, that some were even sold as slaves to North Africa via the port of Genoa, some even as far as Alexandria in Egypt. But the sources are completely silent on what happened to Nicholas, the leader. Did he make it to Rome after all to meet the Pope Innocent III, a very power-conscious pope, who we have already met here several times in the podcast, or was Nicholas also beaten to death or sold as a slave? We simply do not know. The story of the Cologne's Children's Crusade ends as tragically as it does with unanswered questions. A questions is a good keyword. I have a few myself. Let's deal with them after a short break. First of all, I would like to come to the concept of the Children's Crusade, because this is not really an official crusade. Nicholas and his followers did not engage in warfare, nor did they even arm themselves, just as the Peasants' Crusade did in the First Crusade of 1096, which also failed before the Professional Crusade of knights and nobles set out on its own and later captured Jerusalem. The Children's Crusade also had no ecclesiastical legitimacy whatsoever. On the contrary, High clergymen, including the Pope himself, were absolutely opposed to this undertaking. They feared that this was a new outgrowth of heretical activity that they, the Church, could not control. Pope Innocent III was an extremely powerful political pope, even for his time. The popes were no longer now mere pawns of foreign powers like they have been under the Ottonians or Carolingians. They now pursued their own policies and ruled central Italy like secular rulers. Innocent III was particularly active in this respect. But also far beyond his secular domain, he introduced new regulations that would further restrict the daily lives of Jews throughout the Christian world. He waged wars against what he saw as dissenting Christians, such as the Waldensians and Cathars in southern France, and he would himself initiate two official crusades to the Holy Land during his lifetime, even if he was not always entirely satisfied with the outcome, to put it mildly. The Fourth Crusade, for example, took a somewhat strange path when Venetian troops in particular sacked Constantinople, at the time the largest Christian city in the world, by a wide margin. But I digress. The Children's Crusade had not been legitimized by the Pope. It had been a movement from below, from the population. Some would therefore rather speak of a large collective pilgrimage movement, not a crusade. Peaceful, and above all, not legitimized by the Pope. Others, however, argue that the term crusade could well be used for that, because after all, the word crusade simply did not even exist at that time. The sources, which are mostly written in Latin, usually refer to the official crusades like the First, Second, or Third Crusade as expeditio or peregrinatio, and these are both Latin terms for the word pilgrimage. And hadn't crusaders generally always seen themselves as armed pilgrims? The goal was also the same between the official crusades and the children's crusade. Nicholas wanted to achieve this without violence, but the desired result was the same as with the classic crusades before, to reconquer Jerusalem for Christianity and push back Muslim control of the city. This was not just a pilgrimage for personal salvation and to pray at a holy site, just like the military, the official crusaders. The Children's Crusade wanted to create a political upheaval in the Holy Land. So, you see, that's the great thing about historical science, there are good arguments for both. For the sake of simplicity, I will stick to the term Children's Crusade. But historical research is not only concerned with the question of whether this was a crusade or not, also the question of whether the participants were only and all children. The legend we heard at the beginning suggests that children and young people followed Nicholas of Cologne. Is that really true? Were there only children part of this crusade? In the written sources we find, among other things, the Latin term pueri when it comes to the participants of the children's crusade. So what does pueri mean? Directly translated, it would mean boys. In the Middle Ages, however, the Latin term had a broader meaning, namely as a term for poor people such as day laborers, farmhands, and maids. Children were perhaps not the main part of this crusade, but a large proportion after all. That certainly caught the eye of the contemporaries. But we have by no means a uniform group here. The people who took part in the children's crusade were a hodgepodge of different groups. Women were also present. This seems to have been so unusual for the historians of that time that they recorded it. Not only young women, but also women of other ages were present. At least, that's what the Cologne Royal Chronicle claims. Where the participants in the Children's Crusade came from, however, is more difficult. Rainer of Liège, this chronicle describes the participants as shepherds. The Gesta Treverorum, a medieval history of the German city of Trier, states that the people came from towns and villages. In other words, from urban areas and also from the countryside. The chronicle Eberheim Münster emphasizes above all the social status of the participants, mainly farmhands, maidservants, and unmarried women followed Nicholas of Cologne. The latter group in particular suffered a terrible fate when the crusade failed in Genoa. And there is much in the sources, the historical sources, to suggest that it was above all the people at the lower end of society who took part in this children's crusade. Why? We can find out by looking at the motives that might have motivated a person to take part in that after a short break. We have already talked about the goal of the Children's Crusade. Like the Crusaders of 1095 and later on, the Children's Crusade wanted to recapture Jerusalem, albeit by non-violent means, but still with divine help. However, the motives of the participants were more profound and thus show many of the problems and challenges of the time that people perceived. The chroniclers of the time particularly noted the high number of young participants, especially young people and children. Due to a high population growth and high mortality rate, we have a significantly high proportion of young people at that time. Unfortunately, exact statistics cannot be given, but the streets of Cologne will have been dominated by young people. This is very different from today, where the age group of 45 to 65 makes up the largest percentage of the population in Cologne. This shows why the proportion of young people who followed Nicholas was so high. There were simply many of them in Cologne. We are still in the warm period of the Middle Ages, which together with technical innovations in agriculture also produced better crop yields. In other words, many more people survived childhood and many more people could be fed than before. Young people also tend to be, well, how can I put it nicely, since I'm not quite part of the young generation myself anymore. Young people tend to be a bit more rebellious and idealistic. We are the new generation. We still have plans in life. We question the current circumstances. And above all, we will do better than the old ones. I'm sure you can think of contemporary examples, maybe even from your own youth. Doing better than the old ones is not at all far-fetched from the motives of the young people in 1212. Let's take another look at the political situation at the time. The German throne dispute had been raging in the empire for several years, and especially in the Rhinelands. It may well be that two dynasties believe that they are the rightful rulers of the empire by the grace of God, etc., etc., but this was of little use to the simple peasants if constantly plundering armies destroyed their own fields, killed their livestock, or even posed a danger to life and life themselves. Mercenaries from Swabia, Saxony, Franconia, and even from distant Bohemia and England regularly ravaged the Rhineland, no matter which side they were on. The elites of the time, the nobility and the high church, were not exactly held in the highest esteem. They fought extensively over power and prestige in this dispute for the throne. The ordinary people in the countryside, in turn, suffered from the years of fighting. Even the church, the Cologne church, offered no consolation. On the contrary, Archbishop Adolf of Altena himself had been instrumental in the escalation of the conflict, and then, at a certain point, there were even two Cologne archbishops. Oh dear. Peasant families, who could no longer feed their children due to the long war and the German throne dispute, may have sent their children to Cologne to beg or to work. Those who constantly had to ask for alms or beg in the city, who simply had nothing to lose, were more receptive to the message that Nicholas spread in the summer of 1212. So above all, it was not just a crusade of the children, it was a crusade of those who had nothing left to lose, like farmhands, maids, people in debt, but also, yes, children and young people who had no social safety. Do it better than the old ones. I would like to repeat that again. All the crusades in recent times had failed. The idea of crusading had suffered massive cracks. The Third Crusade had ended in 1192 without any great territorial or political gain for Christianity. Although Emperor Barbarossa had personally set off for the Holy Land, he had drowned in the River Zalev in present-day Turkey long beforehand, whereupon his army had disbanded. But the Fourth Crusade took, well, The Fourth Crusade was really something that topped it off, for it went somewhere completely different, as already mentioned earlier. Instead of conquering Jerusalem, the mainly Venetian crusaders plundered the wealthy and above all Christian city of Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire. Constantinople was the great rival of the lagoon city of Venice in the Mediterranean trade. The idea of crusading had therefore been completely perverted in the eyes of many contemporary witnesses. It could not have been any more nefarious. For the Christians in Western Europe, the plundering of Constantinople, which was actually on par with Rome and Jerusalem, was a huge outrage. Although the Pope had not wanted this, as the initiator of the crusade, he was of course partly responsible in the eyes of the contemporaries. But it was not only the Pope who was criticized. The local churches preached a virtuous life to the faithful. They called for moderation and above all condemned wealth. And of course, not everyone should be lumped together. Many clergymen, I believe at that time, really, I believe that, will have pursued their vocation as bishops, priests, monks, abbesses, or nuns out of deep piety to get to heaven. But let's be honest, surely not all of them. The faithful hear about the stories of Jesus and the apostles from the clergy in the churches, what hurdles they overcame, what a rocky road they had. But those who tell these stories, like the bishops, they see themselves in the traditions of the apostles, and they do not live at all like their biblical role models. If you look like a bishop lived, for example, like the one in Cologne, in a huge palace with all his wealth, it was striking that aspiration and truth were far apart here. Preaching water, but drinking wine. Numerous monasteries and convents in Cologne were incredibly wealthy and had many estates. The often aristocratic inhabitants there lived a life that ordinary people in Cologne could hardly even dream of. What was that parable from the Bible again? A camel goes through the eye of a needle rather than a rich man goes to heaven. Now, this is nothing new in the history of Christianity and the Christian Church. In every era, there have always been reform movements and counter-movements that are dissatisfied with the status quo of the church as being too wealthy and worldly. The aim of these movements? Back to the roots. In other words, back to the way things were supposed to be or how they believed it used to be. Be it the Cistercians and Premonstratensians, what a word, in the 12th centuries, like 100 years ago from the events of 1212. Two religious orders that once set out to do exactly that again. Monks and nuns were supposed to work and pray and withdraw from the world. Nothing else, no big riches and fancy meals. But as so often happened with those spiritual orders, over the decades, the rules were relaxed and the Premonstratensians or Cistercian monasteries were lived in the same way that had once been criticized and that led to their foundation after all. And yes, now in the 13th century, we had reached such a point again. The way of the church met with disapproval in many parts of the normal population. New monastic orders would soon emerge in the 13th century in the form of the Franciscans, Carmelites, Augustinians, and Dominicans, some of which would focus primarily on the cities, which was something new as well. These new orders were so-called poor orders, if I translate that correctly from German, because that's exactly what they were, poor, and they were begging all day and lived in poverty. So how do you have to picture that? As a monk or nun, you didn't spend your life as a monk or nun, at least not at that time, in a big, fancy, beautiful monastery in the countryside. No, you walked through the streets of Cologne or elsewhere, dressed in nothing more than a simple robe, often barefoot, and you pursued spiritual tasks. The high ideal was proclaimed to be someone who lives in poverty all day long, all his life or her life long. Against the wealth of the official church, but also against the wealth of the newly emerging economic elite in the cities, like the merchants or the craftsmen. The followers of these The followers of these so-called mendicant orders were only expected to support themselves through donations and alms when they got them. They were not allowed to ask for them at all, much to the annoyance of the local priests, who naturally saw the cheaper mendicant monks as competition, because pastors, for example, often demanded something in return for spiritual services like baptism or funeral. If you did that, you had to go to the priest and said, "Here, you got your 100 medieval dollars or euros." Please don't take that too seriously with the money currency. The mendicant monks did not do this, or at least expected much less in return. The lived poverty of the mendicant monks, this was a reality at the beginning of the 13th century. But you can guess it, in the long term, yeah, the initially strict rules were relaxed here too. The Franciscans would build a beautiful church in the 1240s here in Cologne as well, that you can still see nowadays. So, this was summarized very shortly, the general mood among the people at the time. All of this motivated them to take part in such an adventurous, even hopeless undertaking as what we now see as the Children's Crusade. The destruction in the surrounding areas of Cologne drove many people into poverty and above all into the city in search of a better life. We have a clear surplus of young people in the city. The idea of crusading was in crisis at the time. Where the nobility and clergy had failed, ordinary people now hoped to find a better way in their own way. The crusaders had proved themselves unworthy. God seemed no longer to have them in their favor. So now was the time for the poor and the children. The church preached about the humble and pious life of Jesus and apostles. In the eyes of their contemporaries, however, they did not behave at all like the literary model, so the Bible. The Children's Crusade as an expression of criticism of the elite? Absolutely, I would say that. The support of the rural population reported in historical sources, while nobles and clerics mostly refused any support, also speaks for this. There is a high proportion of young people at that time compared to the overall population. As everyone knows from the youth, young people tend to critically question the behavior of their elders and want to do things differently. And the almost simultaneous emergence of newer forms of piety in the form of the mendicant orders, as well as numerous itinerant preachers of the time who often acted without getting legitimacy from Rome, at least at the beginning of their existence, shows that something was in motion at that time. Let's take a little break before we get to the end. As enthusiastic as Nicholas had been in motivating the people, well, when he and his thousands of fellow travelers arrived in Genoa, often completely hungry and in a miserable state, his authority must have collapsed like a house of cards. For here, in the Italian port city, the sea did not part, as Nicholas had predicted. Those who made their way home were no longer met with enthusiasm. For the rural population, those passing through were just annoying scroungers and beggars who were not wanted in the area. Why should they get help this time? After all, it had not been God's will that the Children's Crusade should succeed. The sea did not part, as promised. But most of them who took part in the Children's Crusade never returned home. Uprooted from their homeland, they now tried to find work as farmhands or maids somewhere. Some reports even speak of many former participants being mistreated and even sold as slaves to North Africa. However, much remains in the dark of speculation. Why are the written sources, the historical written sources from that time, silent on this, about the end of the Children's Crusade? I have no idea. At the same time, there is said to have been a similar Children's Crusade in France. There, a young boy named Stéphane led a Children's Crusade as well, but sorry, people, I would like to make a cut here, because explaining now the French Children's Crusade as well now would go beyond the scope of this podcast episode. What do I take away from the Children's Crusade? Something that was no longer entirely comprehensible to us as a largely secularized society nowadays, at least in the West. how important religion and spirituality were to the people at that time, and that if they couldn't get it from the church, for the reasons already mentioned above, they wanted to get it for themselves. Here, a mass movement had gained momentum that had been completely outside of any secular or ecclesiastical power, a popular piety that was very pronounced. Much of the Children's Crusade quickly became part of legends. The fairy tales of Hansel and Gretel, or the Pied Piper of Hameln, written down in the 19th century by the Brothers Grimm, but existed before that already, by hearsay, were sometimes said to have originated as folk legends from the events of the Children's Crusade from 1220. In Hansel and Gretel, for example, children are cast out and abandoned in the forest because their parents can no longer feed them. Or in the Pied Piper of Hameln, a musician kidnaps all the children from the village of Hameln who never return home. However, this assumption is now highly controversial among researchers. They say it's not true, but still I wanted to put it in here because some of you guys might have heard that. It is difficult to come to an end here. There are still far too many questions, and they don't even fit into a single podcast episode. Above all, why the Cologne area and the Rhineland were so receptive to the idea of this Children's Crusade and other regions weren't, like in Poland, Spain, or England. I hope you enjoyed this excursion into this topic. What I thought would be a simple story of a few thousand children escaping and failing after a few months of traveling in Genoa turned out to be more complex than I thought. And above all, so imprecise. I am really unsatisfied with this episode, from a fact point of view. As I said, more questions remain unanswered than are answered. What did I use as literature? Well, that also puzzled me. I've actually known the story of the Children's Crusade for as long as I can remember, but there doesn't seem to be much literature about it. A comprehensive article by Corinna Röder entitled The Children's Crusade of 1212 in Germany in the Eyes of the Contemporaries, or in German, Der Kinderkreuzzug von 1212 in Deutschland in der Sicht der Zeitgenossen, from the year 1993, published in the volume of Geschichte in Köln, so History in Cologne, an annual volume published by the Geschichte in Köln Association of the same name, where I was also allowed to write a review for a book for the year 2023, and was also a member before my podcast time, was like the only really source I could use for that. The major standard works on Cologne city history have omitted this topic of the Children's Crusade, at least the ones I usually use. As always, Gosse and Peter Garth's Legends of Cologne refreshed me on the legend of the Children's Crusade. In the end, it is time to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my patrons who keep this podcast alive in the long term. And thanks to all of those who left a tip via PayPal this time. Thanks this time to Gabriele, Silvia, Anja, Sandra, Leander, Sabine, Andrea, Maren, William, Klaus, Antje, Miriam, and Christian. Thank you very much. Oh, that was a lot this time. Thank you. I'm flattered. In the next episode, we take a closer look at Cologne as a city. What was it like here around the year 1200? We haven't talked about that at all. A lot has happened since the last time we did that in 1100. What kind of social structures or conditions can we find here? All this and much more in the next episode. Cologne in its bigger medieval city walls now. As always, thank you very much for listening. Recommend me further, and as always, I repeat myself, I see. But auf Wiedersehen.